Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emanuel in this important work, click on the Support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Reason 24, the reason I have just been dreading, because I read this in advance, and it was just overwhelming. The amount of material here is just overwhelming. And I will explain why as we get into the material. So reason number 24 is this. It says, Jesus appears to have been harvested from the Bible and mystery religion God-men. So what does that mean? It means that the story of Yeshua and the miracles of Yeshua and the divine nature of Yeshua is taken from two different sources, one being stories from the Tanakh, and the second source being all sorts of pagan religions, a little piece here, a little piece there, and kind of put into one composite. And that composite then gives us the gospel story, the gospel as we know it, the story of Yeshua. And so, for example, he says, Jesus seems to have been harvested from God-men like Mithras and Dionysus and the God-woman Isis, with suspicious similarities to Buddha and Krishna. So we'll see about, I don't know if we'll get to Buddha and Krishna tonight. I was trying to get to Buddha and Krishna, but I didn't get that far. The reason I've dreaded this one is not because the material is so difficult to refute as much as it's so much to research, because he cites dozens of different mythologies and makes incredible and at points absurd claims about the parallels between the Gospels and these mythologies. And then, in order to answer it, what you need to do is you need to read about these mythologies and try to find the point of parallel that, you know, he is claiming and see if it's a legitimate parallel or not. And this would be a huge task. This is the sort of thing that you could easily spend months. This is like a dissertation. You know, this would be like a dissertation to answer this one chapter of this book, with weeks of research. So knowing that, I was sure to leave it, you know, and put it off until actually 6 o'clock tonight, when I started to dig into it. So we'll see how it goes. I'm sorry. That's why I'm a little disorganized here and just, you know, getting the CDs out now and so on. Anyway, it starts off relatively easily with him making the claim that, first of all, one of the sources for the Jesus mythology, as we might call it, according to his perspective, is actually harvesting from the Jewish Bible, taking stories from the Jewish Bible or prophecies from the Jewish Bible, and then attributing these to Yeshua. And so, particularly Moses and the Moses stories, he points out lots of similarities between Messiah and Moses. And indeed, there are. And the Gospels make this pretty obvious and explicit. All sorts of similarities between Messiah and Moses. But in fact, that is a function of Jewish expectation of Messiah. That Messiah is to be the prophet like unto Moses. That, as it says in the Midrash, the ultimate Redeemer will be like the first Redeemer. So Moses, according to the sages, sets the pattern for Messiah. So for the Gospel writers, if they found a point of congruence, a parallel between the life of Moses and the life of Yeshua, a miracle of Moses, a miracle of Yeshua, that added credibility to the messianic claim of Yeshua, as it should. But Norman is trying to turn that backwards and say that it robs the story of Messiah, the claims of Yeshua, of credibility. So he gives us a quick list of other, aside from just the Moses parallels, a quick list. For example, Yeshua is born in Bethlehem. So Norman points out that there's actually a prophecy in the Tanakh that says the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. So obviously, what has happened here is we've stolen from the Tanakh in order to concoct this tale of him being born in Bethlehem. You see, now this is dirty pool. The escape to Egypt, the Messiah, as an infant, Joseph and Miriam and the young Yeshua escaped to Egypt. And what do we have in the Torah? But we have the story of Jacob going down to Egypt. The heavenly voice that says, "This is my son," at the time of the baptism, seems to actually be gleaned from Psalm 2, where it says in the Psalms, "Today I have begotten you." Right, it is. There's a definite allusion to Psalm 2 there. Psalm 2 is a messianic psalm, and the sages point to Psalm 2 all the time to talk about Messiah. It's well known in rabbinic literature that Psalm 2 is prophetic of Messiah. For example, the feeding miracles. Well, Moses does feeding miracles with manna. And of course, the gospel writers make this quite explicit, especially in John 6. In fact, in the Midrash Rabbah Ruth, it says that Messiah will bring manna just as Moses did. So this was an expectation of the sages. You can't have it both ways. You can't have your sages and eat it too. So there's no problem here. There's no problem with any of these. These are the easy ones. He pointed out some interesting things. He said there's 10 miracles in Matthew 14 and 15, and I didn't check to see if there are 10 miracles, and these correspond to the 10 plagues. I don't know about that. I don't know about that, but it wouldn't be a problem if it did. He points out that there's 10 beatitudes. Again, are there 10? I always thought there was 8. Where are they from? Matthew 5. Someone can count them while we go on. But he points out that these correspond to the Ten Commandments, and so this is like taken from the Ten Commandments. Again, not a problem if that was the case, but I'm not sure there are 10. He points out that the Transfiguration finds a parallel in the story of Moses, who goes up on the mountain, he comes down in his glowing visage. Yeah, I guess that is a parallel. I never really thought of that as a parallel, but I like that. He points out that the derision at the cross, that the master receives derision at the cross, that this is taken from Psalm 22. Yes, Psalm 22 is certainly understood by the apostolic community as prophetic of the crucifixion. Psalm 22 is the psalm that begins with the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? So certainly there's parallels there. There's 9. 9.
And then he goes on to the salt of the earth and light of the world.
Okay, so
the ashrei is the
sign. All right. I guess I'm not the only one who didn't do my homework. And he points out that Yeshua was crucified with robbers, and this seems, and there's a verse in Isaiah 53 that says, his grave will be with the wicked. And so Isaiah 53:9. But again, the apostolic writers would see this as a bonus. This is not a lack of credibility. So those are the biblical, yes, certainly there is parallels and connections in the Tanakh and in the Torah. We don't need to worry about that. If there weren't, we should be worried that this, really probably isn't the Messiah. The fact that he's fulfilling prophecies and so on is not a problem. The bigger part of the chapter relates to these pagan parallels. And I want to preface this by just saying there are pagan parallels to the gospel story. You will find pagan parallels in pagan mythologies. And a frequent motif that you that an archetype, as Linda said, occurs in many mythologies is the idea of a god that dies and comes back to life. Why? Because the gods of the ancient world were reflections of the natural cycle. And that's why you had like storm gods, because you had storms. And that's why you have a moon god, because the moon, you know, is, shows up in the sky. And you have a sun god, the sun comes up. And so you have seasonal gods as well. There's and agricultural gods. And so these seasonal and agricultural gods are the ones that you really have to worry about the most, especially if you're doing agriculture. And so if you're doing agriculture, you need to keep these agricultural gods happy. And you see a pattern, a definite pattern of things are they come alive and they grow and they grow and they grow. And then there comes a time when everything dies. You know, and we call that winter. Or in Israel, you call it summer. This is kind of the reverse of what we experience here. But nevertheless, it's still this seasonal pattern of growth and followed by death, which is then followed by a new birth, a rebirth, perhaps a resurrection in the spring when things start to grow again. So this is an archetype, a theme that will be found in every mythology. And I mentioned to you the last time we met that this was, in fact, it was this particular thing that kept C.S. Lewis at bay from Christianity. C.S. Lewis, who we now know as the greatest apologist of our time, in my opinion, C.S. Lewis, the greatest apologist of the Christian faith of our time, was not a believer. And the reason he was not a believer was because, you know, he was a great scholar, and he knew the old mythologies so well. And his point was that, well, you know, this sounds just like another of the old mythologies. You've got a god who dies and comes back to life. To which Tolkien replied to him, Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, replied to him and said, precisely, but this is God's mythology. In other words, this is the real deal. And so there's some truth to the archetype, but just because it's a human archetype doesn't disqualify it from the realm of truth. In fact, Paul talks about, in his lecture at Mars Hill, he talks about how the pagan reaches out in the darkness to grasp truth. And so there are elements of truth in every religion. This was Paul's point. But he goes on to make a strong case for monotheism in that same section of the book of Acts. And then, of course, introduces Messiah. Anyway, so let's start running through these pagan mystery religions. First of all, I want you to know where our author is getting, Asher Norman is getting most of his information, because I can tell you this, none of this is his original research. From what I've seen, he's using secondary sources or thirdary sources, if there is such a thing. I would call it junk scholarship. He's relying very heavily on junk scholarship. Now, if you were to go on the internet and simply Google some things, I know this because I did this about an hour ago, and you will find all sorts of anti-Christian junk scholarship web pages will pop up with all of this and more. And there's an incredible amount of this out there. Well, you know, you see this sort of thing all the time, where people put things out there without any sort of substantiation. Then someone else picks it up and repackages it and puts it out there with even less substantiation, and it's been embellished. And then it gets put out there again with even crazier ideas, and these things grow and grow and grow. And then the whole messianic movement believes it. That's kind of the progression, the natural progression of things. Asher Norman is going to say that there's a lot of similarity between the Canaanite god Baal and Jesus. How so? Both are the son of a god, which is true. That's true. But this is something that's going to be true for all the gods. You know, every god is going to have this going. He's going to, you know, if he has a father, you know, he's a son of a god because yep. gods beget gods yep. in pagan mythologies. All right. So yes, Bel is the son of a god, and he has a battle with Mot. You know, Mot in Hebrew, death. It's death. Yeah. So there's, of course, there's a similarities, cognates in the language. He has a battle with death, the god of death, and then he comes back to life. And yes, he comes back to life. Now, Bel is your storm god. He's your rain god in the ancient world. If you follow the seasons in Israel, you'll see that you certainly have a wet season beginning around Sukkot and extending to Passover, and then a dry season beginning around Passover and extending to Sukkot. It doesn't rain in the dry season in Israel. It really doesn't. It's a long, long dry season. So their summer is the period of time when things die, when vegetation dies. And this is the ground, this is the home stomping grounds, Mediterranean seaboard, is the home stomping grounds of the god Bel. And as the rain god, the mythology very naturally, you know, complements this, that he dies, Mot kills him, and then he comes back to life.
Every year?
Yeah, well, you know, he did it once, and that has a cosmic effect of being repeated every year, I guess. But so here's what we need to be asking ourselves, though. As you think about the first century Judaism that birthed our faith, to what extent would that first century Judaism be copying or wanting to copy Bel mythologies, ancient Canaanite and Phoenician mythologies, of which they would probably not even know the details? We know the details. Why do we know the details of these? Because, you know, because of clay tablets, which we've found and deciphered and so on, and Ugaritic documents that archaeologists have recently been able to retrieve. That's the only reason we know the details. Obviously, though, if you're trying to establish a religion, a Jewish religion particularly, you're not going to be invoking Baal. right? Okay, so I'm not terribly concerned about the Baal and Mot. There's really no parallels other than the dying god coming back to life god aspect with Bel and Mot. So then the next one he lists for us is Adonis, who is apparently raised, you know, as another dying god who is raised on the third day. And so this could be homework for someone. Go home, study Adonis, learn about the Greek god Adonis, and find out if the parallels in the Adonis mythology warrant comparison with the gospel. Find out, particularly you might want to find out if there really is a 3-day interim between his death and resurrection. Well, first you would want to find out if there is actually a mythological death and resurrection of Adonis.
What religion is that?
This would be Greek.
Okay.
Yeah. But then find out if there really is a source, a solid source, and not just some sort of internet scholar, a solid source that would that puts it at a 3-day interval. I'm just curious. The reason that I'm a little bit skeptical is because some of the ones that I did check out, I did not find any of the solid parallels that are being, you know, are being reported here. I would be curious to see if that's actually the case. The difficulty is with all of these, and I'll speak to the Krishna and the Buddha ones because those are the ones I didn't really have time to spend time with, and they seem like the least relevant. The idea that, you know, the cults of Krishna and Buddha are so far removed from the Mediterranean world that gave birth to the Gospels
and even the Roman world, they're so remote that the idea that they would have had any influence whatsoever is a little over the top. And yet the parallels, the Krishna and Buddha parallels, oh, I should just read you some of these parallels. They're just, if you were a person who was considering, I wonder about Christianity, I wonder about the Gospels, I wonder about the New Testament, if any of this has any validity. Listen to this. Jesus and Krishna. Krishna had a forerunner, or both had a forerunner that preceded them. They were both born in a city distant from their homes. They were each sentenced to death by a king, fearful for his throne. They both lived under the rule of a king who ordered the massacre of male children. They both cured a leper and restored people to life. They washed the feet of their disciples. Both had a beloved disciple. Both descended to hell and to heaven before witnesses. Both are said to be God incarnate. Both were pierced and crucified. Their deaths resulted in a darkening at noon. They were resurrected and will return in the end of days. That's Krishna. Buddha, it says they were both baptized in the presence of the Spirit of God. As boys, they both went to their temples at the age of 12. Buddha was 16. And astonished all with their wisdom. They were the same age when they began their public ministry. I don't know what age the master was, but they were both tempted by the devil. Their followers required each of them to provide a sign so they might believe. Both strove to establish a kingdom of heaven on earth. Did you know Buddhism at all? I know Buddhism a little bit. I'm sorry. This is true. Both made very similar wisdom statements. Yeah. That is true.
What came first, though?
Well, it's wisdom is wisdom.
Buddha came first.
By about 500 years, I think.
Who am I thinking of?
Each of them healed a blind man. I'm not sure about that. They were itinerant preachers with an inner party, inner and outer group of disciples. Well, Buddha. Yeah, so is everyone. Buddha's. Yeah, that's true regarding Buddha in that he said he didn't want to teach because the people who he was trying to, communicate his wisdom to, he felt that they wouldn't accept it, and then he received a prophecy that said some will. So I guess inner and outer. Anyway, it goes on like this, and then there's more. The problem is, I'm just bringing this up because the Buddha and Krishna parallels are really, they have no basis. That there's no real concern there. The problem is that when you have a broad mythology, you can pick out any one element and then say, oh, here's a similar element. Both had mothers. Oh. Well, according to Asher Norman, they all claim to be born of a virgin. Is that true? Well, his mother was Queen Mahamaya, Suddhodana's wife. On the night that he was conceived, Queen Maya dreamt that a white elephant with six white tusks entered her right side. 10 months later, he was born, and according to Shakya tradition, when his mother became pregnant, she left for her father's kingdom and gave birth on the way. So she's a queen, she's married to a king, and she's not a virgin. Here's why does this matter? Why am I bringing this point up? I was editing a document by Rabbi Isaac Lichtenstein today, and he was arguing with someone, and he said, "He who errs once can lay no claim to infallibility." Asher Norman, in the presentation of these pagan parallels, errs not once, but again and again and again and again. In fact, in the parallels I have looked at, it's been rare to find one that actually does have a correspondence, a claimed correspondence. Anyway, let's look at some of the research that I actually have done. Well, let's look at Attis. According to Asher Norman, Attis was born of a virgin mother. The gods had a problem with his father, and so they castrated him. And instead, his seed, so to speak, grew up into an almond tree. And when its fruit was ripe, Nanna, who was the daughter of the river god Sangarius, picked an almond. And then the almond disappeared, and she became pregnant. Attis was, he's a god who dies and is resurrected. But when he was resurrected, as a pine tree. It's interesting stuff.
It's a lot more faith.
Well, that's another point. It takes a lot more faith. No, it really doesn't. No, because these stories are not rooted in history whatsoever. They're not part of. They're not expected to be literally true. You know, the stories of the gods are, they're cosmic. They're in the cosmic, mythological, realm. You know, you don't think of it like as if it literally happened. It's on a god level. You know, when Marduk ripped open Tiamat and made the heavens and the earth out of her guts. You know, you don't really think that literally, this literally was it happening like this. So I think it takes less faith. The difference between the primary difference between all of these mythologies and Christianity is that Christianity makes a claim to be rooted in historical fact, that it really happened in a definite time, a definite place, definite people were there, there were real witnesses, and so that moves the story of the gospel really completely out of this realm of mystery mumbo jumbo. But nevertheless, the claim is that the mystery mumbo jumbo wields a heavy influence on the composition of the Gospels. For example, Attis was mourned at the time of his death, and so there's a mourning ritual. His cult had a mourning ritual. And Asher Norman says that this is the origin, or implies strongly that this is the origin of Lent. Right? No, that's not true. But here's an interesting thing. Attis was born on December 25th.
Oh.
Well, I can't find that either. That may be, just because I haven't found it. You know, his birth date isn't recorded on Wikipedia for some reason. But...
because they don't know.
Right. It could be. December 25th is going to be a popular birth date for gods, because it's the solstice. Yes.
The
solstice is the 21st. But in the ancient world, you couldn't really see the couple seconds of difference in sunlight. By the 25th, you could say, the days are getting longer. Definitely. And so...
And there's a point in time where the sunset or the sunrise is still getting earlier or later, but the other one is opposite. So the sun may continue to set later, but the sun's coming up earlier.
So
it takes a couple of days.
To swing the thing around. Yeah. So 25th is considered the ancient solstice. The 25th is going to be popular in any sort of pagan religion, because here you've had a situation of absolute terror where it looks like the whole world is going to freeze or something. You know, the sun is disappearing. Each day is getting shorter and shorter. Darkness is descending upon the face of the earth. And then there's a moment when everything turns around and starts to get better. And that is the solstice. And so that's going to be, a good time for...
celebration.
Yeah, a god to come into the world. So I don't know about Attis. How about Isis, though? She's more interesting. Isis, Egyptian. Yes. So you might think, well, now wait a second. We're gonna bring in ancient Egyptian pantheons into this mix. What would an ancient Egyptian goddess have to do with Judaism or even with Roman Christianity. But it turns out that Isis enjoyed a big revival in the Hellenistic era, and she became quite a popular goddess again, and her mythology became popular through the Roman world. So she actually could wield some influence, if we're looking for influence. According to Asher Norman, here's the similarities. Isis has a religion that involves immersion and confession of sin. I don't know about confession of sin. I can't imagine, knowing Isis, I can't imagine what qualifies as a sin for Isis. But immersion, almost certainly. Immersion is pretty much a universal purification rite. And so lots of religions employ immersion. But don't forget, Judaism has immersion before Christianity. So you're cutting, this is a matter of sawing off the branch you're sitting on, which is really a problem. Because you remember when we were talking about, you know, equal weights and measures, that, you know, if you're going to criticize the rabbinic methodologies that are manifest in the New Testament, you would have to criticize rabbinic methodologies that are manifest in rabbinic literature, right? So we're saying that's equal weights and measures. Well, I'm going to give you another equal weights and measures standard. This is equal weights and measures of pagan antecedent. If you're going to pull out pagan antecedents, you know what an antecedent is? Yeah, what preceded, yeah. If you're going to pull out a pagan antecedent for the New Testament in order to disqualify the New Testament, would it not then just be fair to do the same for the Tanakh?
It's easier.
And it's easier. Yeah, there's more of them. All of the biblical festivals, for example, we can find pagan versions of the biblical festivals. Everything from the sacrificial system to the tabernacle to even stories that are, you know, beloved stories like Noah and the Ark, for example, it appears in Epic of Gilgamesh. There's pagan parallels to most of what is held sacred in the Bible. In fact, my brother likes to point this out. Because he finds the paganoia in the Messianic movement really troublesome. And paganoia.
That's the word actually
paralleled. It's paranoid of paganism. Yeah. A lot of people come into Messianic practice because they're afraid of paganism. Because they say, oh, there's so much paganism in Christianity, we're finally free of the paganism of Christianity. That's what I mean by paganoia. My son Isaac coined the term. So a lot of people come into Messianic practice because of that. That's a terrible reason. You know, when people show up and they're like, we want to worship here because we wanted to get away from all the paganism of Christianity, that tells me right away, you're going to hate Judaism. You know, Judaism is not the religion for you. You're looking for something that, you know, just like some crystal pure thing that just beamed straight down and has, you know, it's not going to happen here. It's a problem. That paganoia thing is a problem. But look, my brother points out, he says, we have psalms in the Bible that are plagiarized from other religions. You know, there's whole psalms that are taken from other religions. And my brother says, I don't see any problem with that. You know, some Israelite, some Levite, he hears this hymn to Baal and he thinks, I like that. That's got a good tune. So he just takes it and he takes the name Baal out and sticks the name Lord in, and it's like a, you know, I mean, does this not happen in the contemporary Christian music market all the time? So, yeah, we don't want to play that game, but that's the game we're playing right now. Okay, so immersion. It's immersion got us off on that tangent. That there's some salvation through repentance with Isis. I don't know. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know what that would even mean under an Egyptian pantheon. What does repentance look like? I don't know. Isis and Osiris have a son born December 25th. Yes, probably. Probably. That would be Horus, I believe. No, Horus is born January 6th. So, Asher Norman points out that both of these dates, December 25th and January 6th, and the 12 days of Christmas between them. both of these are traditional birth dates assigned to Jesus. I'm not going to fight with that, because that's not in the Bible. You know, that's a later tradition that's been added on here. I'm not terribly concerned about this, because I don't have to defend this. This is something that's not even really part of Messianic tradition. You know, I mean, it is to some extent, because, you know, there's still the old Hanukkah bush that shows up, right, in Messianic congregations on December 25th. So I'm not going to try to defend it. Now here's another one. And this is a real parallel too, that you can see a strong parallel between the Madonna iconography in the early church, which is what? The mother and the child, with the child at the breast, right? There seems to be a real natural transition from Isis iconography, because Isis is often depicted with Horus at her breast. So that's kind of a standard worship idol for Isis. And so that does seem to, you know, that could very likely have been an influence behind the Madonna iconography. Again, we're talking about later church traditions. Okay. So that sort of gives us the rundown on Isis. I thought he said that Isis was a virgin. I've heard that anyway. I mean, there's so many versions of this junk. Isis is, he doesn't bring it up. Oh, yes, he does, because, yes, he does. Oh, yeah, because he's got Osiris, who actually turns out to be Horus, but it can't be Horus because that's her son. So Osiris is her husband. So there's some sort of like reincarnation that happens there or something, I don't know, where you become your own father. But, you know, these mythologies get mixed up and confused over a couple thousand years of moving from culture to culture. Suffice to say, Isis, not a virgin. Mithras. What can we say about Mithras? Do you know Mithras? Mm-hmm. Mary Mithras. That's an old joke. Apparently, and the reason people say that is because apparently Mithras was born on December 25th as well. So how many gods can be born on December 25th?
All of them.
I don't think there's any evidence that Mithras was born on December 25th. Mithras is one of these religions of which we know almost nothing. It was a big time mystery religion in the first century, because it was the religion of the Roman legions. However, so there's lots of archaeological evidence. Mithraism has left lots and lots of statuary, and there's temples and shrines to Mithras, but there's almost, in fact, there is no textual information left behind. The Mithras people did not have scriptures. There were no Mithras scriptures. So almost everything that we know about Mithras has been different people speculating and putting together, you know, trying to look at the statuary and the icons and the sanctuaries and trying to say, well, here's what Mithraism was. We know this. Mithras killed a bull, because in almost every picture he's killing a bull. And we also know that there was a sacred rite for initiates into the Mithras cult that involved some sort of meal. They had some sort of meal. We know this because Justin Martyr complains that he complains about it. He says that Satan copied the Eucharist in the Mithric meal, which, you know, is a little ridiculous. But Justin Martyr just gets us into more trouble than. Pardon me?
What does he say again? Satan copies.
Well, because let me explain. If we were a part of the Mithras religion, you couldn't come because it's just for men. and it's all secret. It's a mystery religion. It's all secret. Everything that happens here is secret. So we don't tell anyone. We don't write anything down. And that's why scholars don't know what happened there anymore. But that leaves scholars lots of room to invent what happened, and what they come up with is strikingly similar to Christianity in many cases. But that's all based on speculation. One thing that we do know is that they had altars, that they had a sacred meal around these altars, and that Justin Martyr complains that the sacred meals are, he thinks, Satan's counterfeit copy of the Eucharist. All right, Justin Martyr probably was not at one of these meals either. In the Mithras mythology, he kills a bull. He kills this great bull, and then you eat the bull. And that's what's going on there. So Asher Norman says, here's what we know about Mithras, and really we don't know anything about Mithras. Mithras was a mediator between God and man. We don't know that. But it would not be surprising if he was a mediator between the gods and humanity. That's a normal sort of thing. Mithras aided the ascent of the human soul. Probably. That also is a normal sort of religious impetus, don't you think? He was worshipped by shepherds. No. No, I think that's just trying to pull together the bull thing. And he performed miracles. We don't know that. He could have. We don't even know if he was a guy. I mean, I think he was a god. Gods always perform miracles. That's what they do. There's the Eucharist thing I already mentioned. Now, this would be telling. Initiates into the Mithras cult had to go through baptism. Well, no. They probably had to go through some sort of purification, right? But no, initiates to the Mithras cult had to go through scholars think it's like 7 different trials. And it was like entering a fraternity. You know, there was hazing rituals going on with the Mithras cult. And it's Roman soldiers, you know? Right. Who's tough? And so then there's Mithras is going to come back and fight an apocalyptic battle. Again, how would we know that? Just from statues of pictures of him killing stuff, I suppose. But he's a soldier god. So there's entirely too much made about the Mithras parallels to Christianity. And this is a real normal thing. I've been hearing about Mithras for years and years and years, and I just always assumed it's true. You know, because you hear it so many times, I just assumed, well, it must be true that there's all these incredible parallels between Mithraism and Christianity. But when I really looked into, I did my serious hard research here of writing Mithras in Wikipedia. I don't find any compelling parallels. Okay, so now what about Osiris Dionysus? Now, this is amazing to me. Osiris and Dionysus are two different gods. It's not the same god. But he's going to lay all these parallels between the, quote, Osiris and Dionysus myth and the Gospels. Osiris is Egyptian. Dionysus is Greek. Osiris is one of the sons of Isis. Dionysus is the god of wine. What do they have to do with each other? Nothing that I could figure out. So where does he get the idea that Osiris and Dionysus are really, the same god? He says Osiris is seen on wall paintings in Egypt, yes, 1250 BC. Osiris and Dionysus had been equated by the 5th century BCE. Who says? I couldn't find any equation between Osiris and Dionysus. I was looking for this. So I want to know who does say. Well, the answer is that all of his information comes from Freke and Gandhi's book, The Jesus Mysteries. And this is really the bomb. If you want to find out where this information is coming from in reason number 23, this is the book to get. Freaking Gandhi's The Jesus Mysteries. This is where Asher Norman's getting all of reason number 23. is from a book of junk scholarship called The Jesus Mysteries, which is, it's not written by scholars. I did a little internet sleuthing. It's not written by scholars. It's has all the credibility of Dan Brown. It kind of runs in the same circles as Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code kind of thing. And making all of these preposterous claims of parallels. So one of the things that they claim is that Osiris and Dionysus are really the same god. They're not. So what are the parallels between Osiris and Dionysus? Supposing that they are the same, that there is this kind of melding of Osiris and Dionysus, what are the parallels between Osiris and Dionysus and the Master? Well, for one thing, they're both saviors. Even so, in what way? Osiris, yes. Osiris is a savior in that he's the god of the dead in the underworld, and he'll get you through hell. But he's like the mummy god. But Dionysus, he's a god of wine. I don't know what he's going to save you from, unless it's your sorrows. Both of these gods are the son of God. Well, again, they're deities. So yes, they're the sons of deities. Both of them are, Osiris and Dionysus are born of a virgin. Not, she might have been a virgin before. She wasn't. Both are born on December 25th.
I think that's what make attributing Jesus' birth to December 25th is more and more disturbing the more reports I hear of other gods being born on December 25th.
Yes, I agree, but let me just warn you that I don't know I could not find hardly any of these, any evidence that would link them to December 25th. I think a lot of this is just anti-Christian speculation. Really, I do. I really think that a lot of these parallels going back for several hundred years has come out of the Enlightenment era, where it just became very cheek to try to show that Christianity is not legitimate.
Do you think Jesus was born on December 25th?
Not a chance, no.
What did she say?
She asked me if I thought that Jesus was born on December 25th. That would just be too cute.
Yeah. One more time.
I said that would be just too cute for him to be born on December 25th. It's
just too popular.
And it's
unique.
It shows up too late in Christian tradition, mm-hmm. is the main thing. I mean, none of the early church fathers have any mention. All right. What else? December. A star is associated with the birth of Osiris and Dionysus. I don't know anything about a star associated with Dionysus, but I believe there is a constellation associated with Osiris, which stands to reason. It's not exactly the same as a star. And then this was a bizarre claim. I really have to read it to you.
I think he's really banking that no one checks all this out.
Yeah.
Well, it's the sheer weight. It's the sheer weight. When you just read these one after another after another, the sheer weight of the claims, you end up saying, wow, it's all, it's all pagan junk. It's all made up. It really seems, you wouldn't even think that you have to check it out, because there's just, the sheer weight of this is just overwhelming. But listen to this. The birth of Jesus in Bethlehem was shaded by a grove sacred to Osiris and Dionysus. Now, this is, wait a second. We don't know where he was born in Bethlehem, unless you're saying the whole town of Bethlehem was overshaded by a grove sacred to Dionysus and
Osiris. There'd be no place for the sheep.
Why would? How would you have a grove sacred to Osiris and Dionysus overshading Bethlehem? Osiris and Dionysus are born again through baptism. Don't know about that. Turned water into wine. Did they? Now, you would think that this would be a great maneuver for Dionysus. If anyone is going to do this, it would be Dionysus. Right? But as far as I could find, there is no indication anywhere that he ever pulled this off, that Dionysus ever turned water into wine. There were some scholars back in the 19th century, or one scholar at least, who was suggesting that the water-to-wine incident might have been influenced by a Dionysus myth. But the myth is missing. So he suggests that the water to wine is to show that Jesus is superior to Dionysus. That would be fine if it wasn't for the fact that we have plenty of material in Judaism itself about the significance of wine miracles in the Messianic era, in the Messianic age. It has no relationship to Dionysus. But according to Asher Norman, Dionysus turned water into wine. Both they were transfigured and recognized as divine by their followers when they were transfigured. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think Dionysus was ever not recognized as divine, nor do I think Osiris was ever not recognized as divine. They didn't incarnate that I know of. Maybe some of you know your mythology better than I do. But Dionysus shows up, and sometimes, the gods are always doing this, especially the Greek gods, they're always showing up and pretending to be humans and then pulling off some sort of spectacular thing. Hey, let's all have drinks, something like that. I could see Dionysus doing something like that. But he's not like a man that then you later realize, he's divine. Okay. Osiris and Dionysus had 12 disciples. We don't know that. I don't see any evidence of that. Triumphal entry on a donkey. I do believe Dionysus rode on a donkey. Yes, I'm pretty sure Dionysus shows up on a donkey and he's got lots of jugs, of wine on this donkey too. That's not the same as a triumphal entry. As the triumphal entry narrative, which has strong precedent in the prophets, in Judaism, and also in rabbinic literature. And you don't need to look to Dionysus to understand the donkey. Crucified at Easter time for the sins of the world. Wrong. Dionysus is not crucified. Osiris ends up, he's not crucified, he's more dismembered. Not at Easter time in November, I believe. I might be confusing him with his father, though. Well, so did the ancient world. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Osiris' death is in November, and then Isis has to go around and gather up all the pieces of him, and then he becomes like the mummy god or something like this. I don't know. Wrapped in linen, anointed with myrrh. Don't know. I don't know where that would come from. Descended to hell and rose on the third day to ascend to glory. Not. Osiris descends to hell, never rises to glory. He's still there. He's still ushering the dead through the Egyptian afterlife. Okay. Three women followers at the tomb. What tomb? Isis collects all the parts of Osiris and puts them in a coffin. That's one woman follower, his wife or his mother, depending on where we are in the mythology. Certain important pieces are missing. Right. Will return as judge in the last day. I can't see this. I can't see Osiris returning.
From the Greek.
I really, really can't see Dionysus being appointed the judge over the last day.
On the how judge God or God,
yeah.
Whatever.
Right. And finally, their deaths are celebrated with bread and wine.
Wine?
Yeah.
Everything's celebrated with wine.
Yeah. Let's see what we can. I've got some Dionysus information here. I don't think so. Certainly all the church fathers were pretty insistent on this, the early apostolic fathers were pretty insistent that all these pagan religions were introduced by demons in imitation. And so that certainly was their line. And from a spiritual perspective, of course, that's true. From a human and sociological perspective, it's not necessary even to have demons introducing such parallels. Human culture evolves naturally along the same lines. We're human beings. And so we have the same fears, we have the same needs, we have the same aspirations, and we project those into the spiritual along the same lines. So mythologies naturally take shape along the same lines. We have fathers. So you end up with a father over a pantheon. We have families. We imagine the divine as, you know, as a family pantheon. You know, lots and lots and lots of similarities. There's a natural reflex that seems to be hardwired into us to understand that the gods like sacrifices, because all over the world in every culture you sacrifice to the gods. That's a basic instinctual in human hardwired into human beings. So I think a lot of it has to do with our spiritual psychology. There's even a recent book that came out. I can't remember the title, but the point of the book was that he pointed to the structure of the human brain to say that we're hardwired to be religious. Mm-hmm. The human brain is like hardwired to be spiritual seeking, and it's just kind of so I think it's just normal. It's just normal. Like, you could take human beings or just like isolate human beings isolated from human society and plop them down somewhere else in the world where they had no other contact, and then came and checked on them in 1,000 years, they would have a developed mythology that probably would have parallels to a lot of this stuff. Eat it. But this should answer all of our questions regarding Dionysus, at least. Because this is written by a Christian who was responding to charges of parallels between Dionysus and Jesus. Okay? So, Dionysus was born of a virgin December 25th and placed in a manger. That's first claim. Okay. The truth on the matter, his birth was actually always celebrated on January 6th. Well, that's the other Christmas. His mother, Semele, was impregnated by Zeus. Again, not a virgin. He was never referred to as the holy child or placed in a manger, ever. Okay. Number two, his birth was announced with a heavenly display of celestial music. No music. No celestial display. Three, he was a traveling teacher who performed miracles. Well, that's true. Yeah. Dionysus did travel the world, and riding on that darn donkey and getting everyone drunk. Dionysus' miracles were not necessarily helpful either. They were mostly nasty things that he did to people, as I recall. Okay. Number four. Dionysus rode in a triumphal procession on a donkey and is often pictured astride a donkey, which carries him to meet his passion. All right. What does he say about this? Dionysus was depicted riding a donkey. Yes. And waving ivy branches, which was the typical homecoming for any royal figure. The crowd welcoming Jesus to Jerusalem were also practicing a triumphant homecoming. So this sort of could be called a parallel. The idea of him going to his passion, however, comes from Freke and Gandhi, the Jesus Mysteries. Number five, he was a sacred king killed and eaten in a Eucharistic ritual. There is an unofficial story in which he, as an infant, is attacked by titans who eat everything but his heart. Okay, so the parallel that we're trying to make here is that, Jesus says, this is my flesh, and Dionysus also is a god who gets eaten. All right. not a parallel. Dionysus rose from the dead on March 25th. No. The date of his resurrection after his murder by Titans is in November. Okay, he was a god of he turned water into wine. No. But he did, after introducing wine to the world, he called it the water of summer. So that's as close as you're going to get to that parallel. He was called King of Kings and God of Gods. No, he wasn't. He was considered the only begotten Son, Savior, Redeemer, Sin Bearer, Anointed One, Alpha and Omega, Lord God born. Of these, the only title applied to him is Savior. And in the context in which he is referred to as Savior, he was saving people from the wrath of Pentheus, not from sin or damnation. So, not even comparable. But did you hear that list? You see, people are just lying. These are just crazy, absurd things. He was identified with a ram or a lamb. He had horns. Okay. His sacrificial title of Dendrites, or young man of the tree, intimates he was hung on a tree or crucified. This was no sacrificial title in any sense. He was simply called young man of the tree. That does not suggest that he was crucified. But this is this guy's refuting the research of freaking Gandhi and the Jesus ministries. At his trial, Dionysus is described by freaking Gandhi as a quiet stranger with long hair and a beard who brings a new religion. Dionysus was never quiet. As for long hair and beard, that's pretty normal for the ancient world. Number 13, he offers his followers a chance to be born again through rites of baptism. No. Followers of Dionysus never claimed to be born again, and their baptism had to do with waving a fan above their heads, not submersing in water. Okay. And number 14, his followers await his return as the judge during the last days. Not true in any version of the Dionysus stories. I like that because this is one guy who actually spent more than an hour and actually checked out the claims.
What was his name?
I don't know. It was just on the internet, you know? It was a Christian website it had a whole bunch of these. So what's the point here that I'm trying to make? It's a larger point. What is it? It's this. Reason number 24 completely falls apart. And we're not even, you know, so that's why I don't feel bad about not even going to Krishna and Buddha. Because it's the same kind of junk, the same kind of junk scholarship and absurd claims, and it's completely outside of the Mediterranean world. So freaking Gandhi say, early church fathers such as Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Irenaeus were understandably disturbed by the similarities between Christianity, especially the rite of the Eucharist, I think that's the only thing they mention, and the pagan mystery religions, and resorted to a desperate claim that these similarities were the result of diabolical mimicry. Using one of the most absurd arguments ever advanced, they accused the devil of plagiarism by anticipation, of deviously copying the true story of Jesus before it had actually happened, in an attempt to lead the gullible. These church fathers struck us as no less devious than the devil that they hoped to incriminate. That's what freaking Candy say. Asher Norman concludes, he says, there is no precedent or theological concept in Judaism that the Messiah will be divine or will be resurrected after his death. Judaism applies the resurrection concept to all worthy people in the Messianic era. Well, that's true. Jesus bears a remarkable resemblance to the pagan demigods Isis, not Mithras, not Dionysus, not redressed in Jewish historical motif. The profound similarities between Jesus, Mithras, Isis, Dionysus demonstrate that there was an archetype being repeated in different cultures rather than coincidence. It appears that much of the supernatural history of Jesus was simply a copy of these earlier gods. So that's reason number 24. You know, so I sat here for an hour and just like, I'm kind of asking you to believe me, you know, that this is bunk. But if you want, go home, get on the computer and check it out, you know, but don't trust just any website. You know, use something credible. But this is a problem. To really do an academic job, a good scholarly job with real scholarship, would take lots and lots of research, and I'm not talking about Wikipedia. You know, it would take real reading. You'd actually have to go to, say, a library or something. And really, like, dig into, you know, go to the mythology section and probably spend several days, you know, looking for these parallels and so on. And someone should do that. Someone really should do that, and someone should write a first-class refutation of every stupid thing written in this book. But here's the problem. Who will do that? No one. And in addition to that, who's not going to believe this if you already, like, are, you know, questioning? And even worse, most of the Hebrew Roots movement, most of the Hebrew Roots movement is only adding fuel to this fire with the paganoia claims. And in fact, buying this stuff, and so I'll tell you a quick story and then we'll close. So there was this family that worshipped there as well, and they were paganoid. It started off with just discovering about Christmas, I think. And then there's the Easter myth, that Easter is actually Ishtar, and it's like, you know, which is not true. There's no relationship, etymological relationship between Easter and Ishtar. You know, it kind of grew along with this Messianic Apocrypha, this Hebrew Roots paganoia. It kind of grew. So they quit, you know, like many of us, they quit doing Christmas, they quit doing Easter. But they didn't stop there. They kept going, finding more paganism, and more paganism, and more paganism. Well, eventually they moved away, out of the state. But some people kept in touch. After a while, they sent a letter back to the people who were still in touch with them, saying that, in fact, their studies of pagan parallels in the Bible had led them to realize that the Bible itself, the Tanakh itself, is full of paganism.
Oh, no.
And you know, so by now they're, of course, sacred namers and that sort of thing. These things all run together. You know, it's like they all run in the same pack. So someone asks, well, what do you do then? You can't trust the Bible? And they're like, no, we don't even open it anymore. You know.
Oh, no.
And because, you know, the devil is in there, you know, weaving in his paganism. So what do you do? And it's like, well, the only thing you can do is just rely on the Holy Spirit. Was the answer? Which means what? Whatever you make up, right? So that's where it can go. And so I urge you, you know, as Messianic people, to not be seduced by that kind of whiz-bang, oh, look how pagan Christianity is, look at that steeple, it's a phallic symbol, you know, kind of rhetoric that we always hear in the Hebrew Roots movement, because it's in no way constructive. I'll guarantee you that every Christian who is honoring the birth of Christ on December 25th, and sincerely honoring the birth of Christ, is pleasing to the Father in heaven. That there is an association with the solstice or paganism or anything like that is completely irrelevant. This all goes into, there's one word for this, superstition. And our religion is not about superstition.